Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by DX Engineering. DX Engineering offers practically everything you need to outfit your shack, plus the fastest shipping in the industry. In-stock items ship the same day, Monday through Friday until 10 p.m. Eastern. For more information, visit dxengineering.com/hamnation. And by ICOM. For more information, visit icomamerica.com/hamnation.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 149 for May 28th, 2014. How to use your grid dip meter. Hello, everybody. It's K9EID, and we're here tonight with all the usual fun times about ham radio. It's Ham Nation, and we've got a whole bunch of things going on tonight. With us, of course, is George. George, how you doing? Everything okay down there?
Yeah, doing good, Bob. Just still trying to recover from Dayton. I tell you, so much happened while I was gone, I need to catch up on. And then I'm headed out next week, and I should be on live from the new ICOM headquarters.
That's going to be fun. Take a big suitcase empty, and maybe you can bring it back full.
Yes, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're not talking about clothes.
No, radios.
Okay. Yeah. Valerie, how are you doing? How's the wonderful world at DX? Are you doing okay?
I'm doing wonderful. Glad to be back home from Dayton. I had a blast there and enjoying my new prizes that I won. I actually won a Heil BM10 headset while I was there. So that was kind of cool.
Okay. Well, that's good. All right. Well, it was really fun to have you there, and especially the stuff that we did with Ham Nation. That was great. And of course, we got to spend time with our favorite guy from the South, Don. Don, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm good. I'm listening to Brad, NK8J, on D-Star here. And we were talking a little bit. Hang on a second. Brad, are you there? NK8J at E5DW. Say hi to the Ham Nation people on D-Star.
They're on Twitter.tv live right now.
I think I doubled with him. Anyway, Brad's in there, and I haven't been working any six, but I have been playing with D-Star. So, Brad, 73 AE5DW, say hi to Ham Nation.
Well,
hello,
it's sort of
Ham Nation from NKHA, Tony's Girl Morgan.
There you go. There you go. Back to you guys. Let's get the show started for real here.
All right. Well, we got a lot of things going on. Amanda is watching a chat room. She's going to be on a little later, and she's going to have some questions and things for us. So, got any questions you want to ask any of us, why let Amanda know in the chat room. And a lot of things go on. If you aren't in the chat room, you know, want to be there. It's really a lot of fun, and it's easy to find. I just go to the twit.irc.tv. Takes me right there. So check it out. One of the things that I want to do before we get into the real good stuff tonight, I want to talk about one of my favorite items, and it's very old. It's a grid dip meter. And to a lot of people, are going to say, what? What is it? Why is it? Why do we need it? Well, it's one of the most vital tools that I ever had in the early days, and I still use it. And we're going to show you a little bit about what the grid dip meter does. This is a Millen, which I always consider to be the best one. There's a lot of different ones out there, but this was the Rolls Royce. So let's roll that video and let you see what the grid dip meter is all about. This is a very important piece if you're designing. Here's a little two-tube transmitter. And this is something when you look at it and you say, oh, wow, I don't know if I could do it. Yeah, you can. Look at that. There's two tubes, just a few resistors and capacitors. But tonight we're going to focus on the tank coil, the coil and the capacitor that actually tune the transmitter for where you're going to be. Well, you got to know what that coil is. So you got to wind it. Take a piece of solid wire and real sophisticated, I use the end of a screwdriver or whatever. I just kind of judge how big this is, that this coil is going to end up being. And that's why the grid dipper is so important. Make about 4 or 5 turns of that little guy and put it across the capacitor. And you'll find out if it's going to be where you want it to be. I wanted this to come out around 6 meters. And so we soldered it all up. And now, how do you know where it is? You use the grid dip meter. And what that is there's a tube in there. And when the resonant coil is passed through the frequency, you will see the grid of the tube reduced. Thus, it's called the grid dipper. Now, there's all these different coils you saw me with there. We're going to pick out the one for that centers around 50 megacycles, 50 megahertz for the old crowd. And then you see where we have some reading on the meter. And when we put that coil, and we note that these are all different colors, so the bands in there, you can know what frequency we're on. When we take that around 50 megacycles and put it up next to the coil, as we vary the capacitor, see what happens. It actually, I always thought of it, just sucks the energy from the tube and it resonates, thus grid dip. And when you get it down to the minimum, go look at the scale, and it'll tell you where you are. Wow, that was pretty good. I just guessed that, and it came out at 50 megahertz. This is another one. Kenwood made a really nice one. And you can see some of these at Hamfest. They all have an earphone in them, so you can use it to listen to your signal. It's kind of neat. It really was great for AM. And the Kenwood has all the coils in that little box in the end and a little headphone that you can listen to the signal if you want to use it as a field strength meter. Got a little antenna-like on it. Well, that's really neat because you can take that and put it in the circuitry and check to see if there's signal there. So you can use this as a signal tracer also. It's a very useful instrument. A grid dip meter, I couldn't do without it. And it's got so many uses, but I don't see a lot of them lately. And I thought we should talk about it a little. I see them at Hamfest all the time. And at the end of Hamfest, they still lay there because guys don't know. And there's all different size coils and things that you could take the capacitors, hook them up, and see what frequency they are. They have different size coils for all of that. But that just a little treatise on a grid dip meter, and if you see them around at a ham fest, grab one, experiment. And I want to get into some stuff about building a little one and two tube transmitter. It's really easy and a lot of fun, and it's what made this hobby what it is to me today, and why I'm able to do a lot of the things in my professional side, because I learned so much from building. And then from there, took it and away we went. And George, I bet you have a grid dip meter, don't you?
I actually don't, Bob. Well, I sort of do. You know, the MFJ-259B analyzers sell or have some accessories. You can buy the little coil packs that you add to that antenna analyzer and use it as a grid dip meter. I'm not sure if it's good as a real thing, but it works.
Yeah. Well, as long as it works, you have to have some type of a meter or a tool to find out what frequency that you're working with, and that works too. Well, that's super. That's super. Well, one of the places you can look for things like that is DX Engineering, and Don's going to tell us about some of the wonderful things at DX Engineering.
Yeah, DX Engineering is a wonderful place, and of course, you know, if you're building a little transmitter, you need your grid dip meter to tell exactly how you're doing that, but you really need an antenna to get that little transmitter that you just built on the air, and it is antenna building season. Yeah, field day's coming up, and DX Engineering has practically everything you need to design and build your next antenna project. All the components and parts are specifically designed for ham radio applications and will give you years of trouble-free use. Quality aluminum and fiberglass tubing, it's all there to build your antenna, a light-duty mast. The aluminum tubing is strong, durable, lightweight, practically any length you want, multiple outside diameters, too. All sized to smoothly telescope. You can either have them with slit or non-slit ends, depending on your clamping and telescoping application. And perfect tubing if you're looking for maximum strength, even at long assembly lengths. Now, the fiberglass tubing, great for supports, perfect for quad spreaders, stacking insulated frames, 8-foot telescopic lengths and multiple diameters, great for push-up masts. Yeah, make your own. And again, slitted or non-slitted. Light gray fiberglass is also UV and corrosion resistant, and that is important. And it's all available separately or in handy kits with perfectly matched components to let you put up a mast without having to assemble a long bill of materials. Go to DX Engineering, and they'll have exactly what you need. Also, you can put your antenna together with professionally spec'd clamps. DX Engineering is absolutely your best source for virtually every ham radio clamp application because they aren't just typical clamps you'll find at your hardware store. A lot of these are specifically designed and specified by government and defense contractors because they work. They meet exact design parameters, and that's what you get from DX Engineering. Tailor-made to exact tubing OD sizes for the ham radio community. Fully tested under the harshest environments, they meet absolute strict standards. Ideal for building a new antenna and repairing or upgrading your existing antennas. There are isolated clamps that work well for isolating elements on Yagi bills. They carry a huge line of replacement and upgraded stainless steel hardware. And a lot of people overlook this part, but yet it is critically important, and that's a good radial system. And the radial plate mount from DX Engineering will securely mount to your antenna and has 60 points to attach your radio lugs. Stainless steel, stainless hardware, mounts to tubing up to 3-inch outside diameter or a 4x4 or 6x6 wooden post. They also carry all the radial wire and components. Everything you need to get your station on the air and on the air to make the DX contacts because that's what DX Engineering is all about. If you want to grab any of this gear, get your order in by 10 p.m. Eastern. If it's in stock, DX Engineering will put it on a truck headed your way tonight. Proven products, expert advice, the fastest shipping in the industry, DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. Go online, get your catalog, or shop online 24/7 at dxengineering.com/hamnation. dxengineering.com/hamnation. Thank you, DX Engineering, for everything you do for Ham Nation and for Ham Radio. We love you. And we love George, too, and we love the smell of solder smoke. George, hook us up.
Okay, Don. You know, there's two really main types of diagrams we use in electronics. There's schematics that have the actual components on there, the resistors, capacitors, inductors, transistors, tubes, or whatever. And that gives us a detail of all the components. And then there's also block diagrams that just break these down into different sections so you can look at something and get the overall picture of what's going on. Well, what we're going to do this week is take a look at a typical audio mixer and how everything is connected together in there by using a block diagram. And Bob, when this is over, I'd like you to come in and fill in the missing blanks there, because I'm sure there'll probably be a few, but this is, just watch it. I think you'll find out that a mixer is a lot simpler than you think. You know, when I was a kid, I had a fascination with analog audio mixers, and I finally figured out how they worked. So that's what we're going to look at today. Here's a block diagram of the Behringer 802 mixer. Right here in the center is the mix buses. Now, we're going to call this side over here the inputs, this section right here the outputs, and this section down here the monitoring. So let's look at each of these individually. Here's one of the mono input channels. There's two of them on this mixer. They only show one on the block diagram here. You can assume the other one is identical to it. We start out with the microphone jack. That feeds on in through a couple of capacitors here to the microphone preamp. Now, there's a trim control here on the microphone preamp that allows you to set the gain of that preamp to avoid clipping or also to turn up really weak sources. Right up here is 48-volt phantom power for feeding a condenser mic. You can turn that on and off, and that goes through a couple of resistors down to the microphone lines. Now, you'll notice capacitors on this side. That's to block that 48 volts of phantom power, which is DC, from getting to the preamp. Right below that, here's the quarter-inch line input jack. It goes through some resistors here to drop that line level down, because it's going to be much hotter than a microphone level would be. And there's a couple of capacitors here to block any DC that might come in that jack to the preamp. The next section here is equalization. We've got low, mid, and high controls here to adjust the equalization. Out of the equalizer, we go two different ways. First, let's look down here. Here's a little amplifier that drives the clip solo LED. What this LED does is just lights up red if the signal gets too hot. Come out this direction, we've got a level control here, which is often called a fader. This is the main volume control for that channel. That goes through another amplifier. Then that splits out two different directions. It goes to a pan pod here, which allows us to vary how much of the signal go to the left and the right buses. Also, there's a tap here from the output of that amplifier that goes down to the effects send control, which determines how much level we send to the effects bus over here. So that microphone signal coming in can feed both left and right and the effects if we want it to, just as a matter of how we set these controls. Notice that if we change the main level control here, that's also going to change how much a volume is available here at the effects end. A monitor could be connected just right here, same as the others. Come on down, here's our pot, and then that goes on out to a monitor bus, which could be right here. That's the only difference. It's essentially the same as the effects. Now let's take a look at the stereo inputs. They're labeled 3 through 6. There's actually two stereo inputs on this mixer. The first one is called channel 3 and 4 for left and right, and the second one is channels 5 and 6 for left and right. We've got our line input jacks here, and this is balanced. You can see it's feeding both the plus and minus leads of the preamp. Next, it goes to equalization, just like the mic channel did. Then the level control here, which is also called the fader, and this dotted line means those are tied together. When we turn the level on one side, it affects the other side as well. Next, we've got another preamp. Then that goes here to two summing resistors that are connected between the left and the right channels. In the center of those, we've got a tap out here that goes to the effects end, which has a pot right here to adjust the level feeding the effects bus. If we follow it on out this direction, there's a balance control, and then we go on out to the left bus. The same thing for the right bus. You can see those two are tied together. That means when we turn the balance control, it's going to be adjusting the relative level between the left and right channels. Now, back here on the input, you see we've got these lines that are connected from the left input connector down to the right input. What that does, if we only plug something into the left channel here, that's going to feed both the channels of the mixer, left and right. However, if we plug something into the right jack here, it'll disconnect that signal from the left, and then the right channel will feed the right amplifier. Now, there's one more input here we'll look at, and that's the stereo auxiliary return. You can see, as before, we've got two inputs here, and they have a loop between them so that left can feed both. Both of those go to a preamp. Then it goes to the auxiliary return control here. That goes to more amplifiers, and then on out to the left bus and the right bus. You notice here there's nothing so that you could send this to the effects bus. That's because normally you might use this stereo auxiliary return to bring the effects back into the mixer. Now here's what I call the output section of the mixer. Over here is where our mono mic preamps, our stereo line inputs, and our auxiliary return inputs were. You can see they're all connected to the left and right mix bus, as well as the effects bus here. So let's look at each section of this. Beginning right here at the effects bus, you can see the effects lines here. Any of these pots that are turned up over on those channels will be active here on the effects bus. So we have a summing amplifier right here that takes that signal, amplifies it. Then that goes to a line amplifier that increases the volume even more and sends it out the effects send jack. This signal can be used to feed a reverb unit, a delay unit, or whatever you like, or it could even be used for monitoring since this mixer has no monitor section. If we go back over here and look at the left bus, That's feeding a summing amplifier itself. Then here's our main volume controls for the mixer, another line output, and then we go on to the main out jack. The signal from this left amplifier also feeds down here to the tape out, which is the RCA connector output. But it also feeds this way through a switch and comes down to the amplifier that drives the left meters, and it comes on down and goes to the phones and control room pot here. There's another amplifier, and then that feeds to the control room output jack, and it also feeds up here to the headphone amplifiers. Now, the right channel is exactly the same thing as the left channel. Below that, we've got our tape input, the two RCA inputs for left and right. Those go through preamplifiers, go through a switch that allows us to flip it onto the mix bus so that we can play a tape here on these inputs, and that gets to the left and right mix bus. It also comes down here to these switches so that we can flip it and monitor it. I call this the monitoring section down here because it lets you monitor the level controls as well as hear what you're mixing. So this would allow us to flip this switch and only hear what's coming in this jack while not disturbing any of the mix going on up here in the main outputs. So that's pretty much it. That's the block diagram for this mixer. Now, there's a secret that makes this work, and that's what we're going to look at, and it's what it took me a while to find out. The first mixer I ever built was like this, and it had a problem. You can see we've got some potentiometers here. I've got three different inputs here, so I could take a line source, run it into input number one, and then I had a pot here that would adjust how much came on out to the output. And I could do the same thing with number two and number three inputs. The problem was, if you turn one of these down, it affects the other two. You can see if I brought the pot all the way down here to zero, it would be at ground, which meant all of these would be at ground. That's why we add the build-out resistors. These resistors are going to be 10 times the resistance of the input impedance here. So when I bring this one down to zero, this one is still 200K away from zero. Since there's so much loss here in these build-out resistors, that's why we need the summing amplifier. So there you go, the secret of audio mixers. Now, this is for analog mixers. Digitals are a totally different beast. It's really not that complicated. The whole secret is putting build-out resistors in it. So there you go, how basically an audio mixer works. Now, they are a lot simpler and a lot more complicated on that, but they're all basically the same. And once you just learn just sort of how things flow, the signal goes through there, it's pretty easy to operate one. What do you say, Bob?
Absolutely. And it's very interesting, George, because here is the first product of Heil Sound in 1967, and look what it was.
Yeah.
You just drew it. That was your first mixer. It did have summing resistors, because I, too, discovered that this one would affect all of them, so you put the summing resistors. Anyway, that's a piece of history. Probably should have went in the Rock Hall exhibit, but they didn't have, they had it more. And what's interesting about that, George, is, guys will say, well, I can buy this little mixer here and it's $50. And then you see another one that's the same amount of channels and it's $500. And the difference is the quality, the noise floor. When we get into serious recording, we don't want to hear anything. Well, in order to do that, all of the, and the circuit is exactly the same. It's just that the quality of the resistors, they're all film resistors, 1% tolerance, and the sliders, especially the volume controls, the sliders are very expensive because they can't have any noise in their movement. And the EQ circuits are much more defined, but they're all basically that's the same circuit you just showed. Just the components are a lot more military grade. I always call them. You agree with that, George?
Oh yeah. You know, I use a little Behringer mixer here for my HF rig, for Skype and stuff like that. But when I'm going to do some recording, I'll use a much more expensive mixer. I've got a Mackie in there in the house that I use for that. Basically the same thing. Now, you know, there was only one effect send on that Behringer, where the Mackie, you know, has three or four on there, and a set of monitor buses as well. And one thing I didn't mention in there, and, well, actually I did mention it, but it got cut out, is where you tap the signal to go to the monitor bus. You can put it before the fader, or you can put it after, and that's called pre or post fader for your monitor send, so that when you turn up the main fader going to the mix, it won't affect what the talent's hearing in their headphones.
That's exactly right. We were one of the first companies, if not the first, to do monitor sends in 1968. The mixer we started building was much more sophisticated than that one, and we had a pre or post monitor because we were the first guys to bring monitors to the stage. That was with the Grateful Dead and all those the guys. They wanted monitors, but when you had to bring the house up a little bit or bring their level up for the house, you didn't want to change that monitor mix, so then we had to have a pre before the main slider, and that was a revolutionary thing. My goodness, everybody freaked out when that happened, but today it's all common. Only one thing, George, you should remove. You don't need phantom power, right?
No, you don't need phantom power unless you're using condenser mics, which we don't talk about condenser mics here.
No. We don't need condensers. We've proved that now. Okay, that was great. That was really good. That was great. Nice job.
Well, thanks, Bob. I thought that'd be a little blast from the past for you, and it's still the way we do it today. Yep. Digital mixers, that's a whole different thing, but for analog, that's it. And you can build these. It's not that difficult. Maybe working in around an RF environment, yeah, you're going to need to pay special attention to filtering and such, but they're a lot of fun, and a lot of fun to work with, too. Well, you know, I asked a question last week, who is the chairman of this year's Hamvention? And what we're giving away is a Heil USB Q here, the little USB adapter that plugs into the rear of an XLR microphone connector, just like this. You've got gain control as well as bass and treble, so you can equalize it. And it's also got a headphone jack in it, so you've got a headphone volume too. And there is a button on here that says 48 volts, but we won't talk about that because you're never going to need that anyway. But if you, I'd ask that question, who is the chairman? And we had a lot of answers on this, but the one who won was Stephen Daniel, KC2SIZ. And he said Charles Kaiser, KD8JZR, is the chairman of this year's Hamvention. And that's correct. So congratulations, Stephen. We'll be sending this out to you this week. I know that you'll really enjoy it. And for next week, we've got another prize here from DX Engineering. One of these extension speakers you can use on your rig, just a small speaker in a box here with a good mounting bracket and your mini plug to fit the external jack on your rig. You really need an external speaker. Don't use that little speaker that's in the rig. You'll hear a lot better with something like this so that you can really hear those signals, because usually what comes in a rig is, they got to put a speaker in it. There's not a lot of room left, so you don't end up with that great a sound. If you'd like to win this, though, based on the block diagram that we just looked at, there's a headphone jack on there. And answer this for me. On that block diagram, was a headphone jack balanced or was it unbalanced? And if you think you know the answer to that, send me your answer at hamnationcontest@gmail.com. And I might be reading your name next week, and you could win this speaker from DX Engineering. And right now, I think it's time for a little bit of news.
From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 1919, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, May 28th, 2014. Flagstaff, Arizona says no to the recently enacted Coconino County hands-free cell phone ordinance that also bans the use of any push-to-talk microphones. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, has the details.
During a recent working session of the Flagstaff, Arizona City Council, its members rejected the newly enacted Coconino County ordinance as being too broad. City officials paid particular attention to its ban on the use of push-to-talk microphones with two-way radios. In making its decision to opt out, the Flagstaff City Council agreed with member Celia Bartow's assessment that the ordinance would interfere with an amateur radio operator's ability to provide volunteer services and with truckers who rely on 11-meter CB as part of their job. Bartow suggested that the City Council allow the use of two-way radios and focus solely on the issue of texting while driving.
In most states, a county ordinance would trump one enacted by a city, but under Arizona state law, Flagstaff has the option to exclude their community from the new county regulation if it chooses to do so. The operators of the WX4 NHC amateur station at the National Hurricane Center in Miami will be taking to the airwaves Saturday, May 31st. Hal Rogers, KHCMD.
The purpose of the event is to test station equipment, antennas, and computers prior to this year's hurricane season, which starts June 1st. This event also provides good practice for radio amateurs worldwide, as well as National Weather Service staff, to become familiar with protocol and procedures for communications available during times of severe weather. The test will run from 1300 to 2200 UTC. WX4 NHC will be on the air on the high frequency VHF and UHF bands. Among the digital modes to be included in the exercise are APRS and WinLink.
The group is beginning its 34th year of service to the center. Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval has declared June as Nevada Amateur Radio Month. In his proclamation, Governor Sandoval praised the state's 6,800 licensed hams for their commitment in providing voluntary communication services to Nevada and the rest of the world. And Fox News had some very nice words about amateur radio and emergency communications. Here's Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Tennant, K6PZW.
According to Fox News reporter Jonathan Seri, when power, phone, and internet services go down, a battery-powered amateur radio transceiver and portable antenna can provide that crucial link to the outside world. And that's the theme of his two-minute report on the new role for ham radio that emergency preparedness managers nationwide are adopting. Seri hopes that Emory Healthcare in Atlanta is among the growing number of hospital systems to adopt ham radio as a secondary means of communication. He says that hospital administrators and government officials took a lesson from Hurricane Katrina, which left some Gulf Coast medical centers isolated from the outside world as wired telephones and cellular communications failed. Seri interviewed John Davis, WB4QDX, who noted that some of the technology that's been around for almost a century is still relevant. And according to Davis, in addition to major hurricanes, the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 rekindled interest in ham radio as a public safety tool. All in all, a very positive report on one of the major roles that amateur radio is playing in service to the nation in the 21st century.
And before we go, a final reminder that the nominating period for the 2014 Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award will close at midnight this Friday, May 30th. All nominating forms must be postmarked or sent electronically by that time to be considered. You'll find full details and a nominating form on the Newsline website. And we hope to see you in Alabama in August for the presentation at the Huntsville Hamfest. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news brought to you each and every week for over 35 years and counting at www.arnewsline.org. I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW 73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. And speaking of the Huntsville Ham Fest, I found out today that if you remember a couple of months ago, we had when I went up to the Ham Fest at Rain, Louisiana, we had 8-year-old Samuel, who he and his dad had just passed their test. They're coming to the Huntsville Ham Fest, and they're going to be there to watch the Young Ham of the Year Award. So I'm excited about that. And Sam, you're probably watching. So hi, Sam. But right now, let's get a word in from ICOM.
You may have seen it at Dayton, but we've got the scoop on ICOM's new RP5000 and RP6000 series. This VHF-UHF FM repeater is your new analog solution. Debuted at last year's Boy Scouts National Scout Jamboree at the Summit in West Virginia. Now they're available to the public for amateur use, so contact your authorized ICOM dealer for details and programming options. The rugged RP5000 RP6000 covers amateur frequencies in a compact 2-unit slot in a 19-inch rack. It leaves plenty of room for duplexers and other repeater components. The RP5000 on VHF from 144 to 148 megahertz, and the RP6000 is UHF 430 to 450 megahertz. They feature a front-firing speaker and a mic jack, and it promotes repeater or local control radio use, perfect for portable INCOM use. ICOM's superior receiver performance offers excellent selectivity and intermodulation, and it improves repeater service quality even under congested band conditions. The repeaters employ a plus or minus 0.5 parts per million oscillator and high-performance power amplifier. Stable 100% duty cycle operation at 25 watts and 50% duty cycle at a full 50 watts of power output. Additional features include DTMF encoder and decoder, DTMF remote control capability, and a sub-D 25-pin accessory port. And if you're looking for a digital solution, check out ICOM's D-Star repeaters and complete your D-Star infrastructure with ICOM's Buy Direct program. Visit ICOMAmerica.com/amateur for more information on ICOM's RP5000 6000 series. And you can tune in and win after each episode of Ham Nation. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation and throw your name in the hat. You could win some great prizes from the ICOMSwagStore.com. And you'll also be automatically entered in the May grand prize drawing. This month, it's going to be the ICOM ID51A, a full-featured dual-watch VHF-UHF handheld with D-Star. It's got integrated GPS, automatic repeater list-up, and a lot more. So go on over to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation after this episode of Ham Nation and every episode and enter to win. And now, I guess it's time we get Val in here and talk about Dayton After Dark.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about what went on at Dayton after the convention. And, Brian, if you want to go ahead and get that started. While he's getting that going, in the meantime, Amanda's going to be up after me. So if you have any questions for Amanda, make sure you get into the chat room and ask Amanda because she'll be up next. But this year, Dayton After Dark, I'm going to kind of give it to you DX and contest style because there was a lot going on, a lot of dinners and things like that. But mostly, I went Friday night. I went to the contest dinner, which was hosted by the Southwest Ohio DX Association, and that was at the Marriott. And there they inducted into the DX Hall of Fame. Next slide, Brian. Joe Reisert, Whiskey One, Juliet Romeo, and Dave Collingham, Kilowatt 3, Lima Papa. And if you guys recognize Dave Collingham, he was actually on Ham Nation a month or so ago with the video where they went into the middle school in California and did a field day style and got a lot of young hams interested into the hobby. He was also the keynote speaker, and his topic was giving back the humanitarian side of DXing. A lot of these guys, when they go to these islands or countries that are maybe in a hard-to-get area, so they're lacking certain supplies and things like that, what he suggests is that everybody, when they go to these de-expeditions or holiday-style de-expeditions, find out what these countries need. They might need some shoes, or the library might need some books. Or one de-expedition, a gentleman who was a dentist found out that they needed a lot of dental supplies, and so he filled up the rest of the container filled with amateur radio equipment and supplies, and he filled it with dental supplies, and he offered free dental service, which I thought was pretty cool. So that seemed to be a common thread throughout the DXing community, was just giving a little back and mentoring some of these people, teaching them how to put up antennas and a little bit about amateur radio. Later that night, they also announced the de-expedition of the year, which was Amsterdam Island, FT5ZM, which was pretty exciting because I was actually on that team. So I got to go up on stage, and I will be getting up another plaque for my wall. So that was kind of exciting. There was a lot of great de-expeditions out there that this past year. So they were in good company. Later that night, we ran over to the Crown Plaza where the Spurious Emissions was playing. This is a must-see. No matter where you're staying, you need to get over to the Crown next year and check out this band. They do a parody on a lot of the popular songs like Tammy Wynette's. They did Stand By Your Ham. Or the Rolling Stones, they did You Can't Always Work What You Want. It was a lot of fun. It was standing room only. As a matter of fact, it was jam-packed. Next year, I think they need to get a bigger room. But that was definitely the highlight, I thought, of Dayton After Dark in my book. The following night, Saturday night, was the contest dinner, which was at the Crown Plaza. And that too, was a full house. And that was put on by the North Coast Contesting Club. And there, they inducted into the Contest Hall of Fame Vice Admiral John Scott Red, Kilowatt Zero, Delta Queen, and Ed Munns, Whiskey Zero, Yankee Kilowatt. Both fine gentlemen, Vice Admiral Scott John Scott Red, he's actually U.S. retired Navy, a very big wig in the military. Our keynote speaker was Doug Grant, Kilowatt One, Delta Golf. He probably looks familiar to you guys, too. He was on Ham Nation about a month or so ago. Bob Heil had him on, where he talked about his pet project going on right now, which is the WRTC Team Championship, which is like the Olympics of amateur radio, for those of you that missed that broadcast. It's held every 4 years in a different country every year. This year, it's going to be held in the United States, in Boston, in the Boston area. And what they do is they have teams come in from all over the world, two-man teams from different countries around the world, and they all compete to see who the best team is. And to keep it fair, they try and make sure that each team has equal terrain, so no one's on a bigger hill than the other guy. Everybody has the same equipment, same antennas, and they compete, and so they try to keep it as equal as possible, so the competition is based as much as possible on operator skill. And of course, that's a lot of money to put on that event, so they did pass the hat at the contest dinner, and they collected over $10,000 at the contest dinner, which is pretty impressive. Later that night, every night actually, there's always a party going on, especially at the Crown Plaza, which is the contesting and DXing hotel. Pretty much every other floor, there's at least one suite with a party. And the Kansas City DX Club, they have their CW pileup contest every Saturday in Suite 525 at the Crown Plaza. And they've been doing this since 1980. And what they do, when you go into the suite, it's got this big dining room, living room area with a small kitchenette, and off to the, in another room is the bedroom. And if you can see from that photo on below, they set six guys up, or girls and, you know, hams up, with six laptops and headsets, and everybody gets the same pileup in their, you know, tape, audio tape. And the goal is to try and pick out as many call signs as you can and enter it in your laptop. While they're doing that, it's feeding live into a big screen TV over in the other suite room, or the living room suite area, and everybody's watching. And by everybody, I mean everybody, because it is so packed in that room because it's a live leaderboard, and it's pretty fun to see. Unfortunately, I didn't find out who the winner was. I was hoping to find out before tonight's live broadcast, but unfortunately I didn't. But it's definitely a fun thing. Just to, you don't even have to participate. It's fun to go and check it out. And that's pretty much it for Dayton After Dark. Now, coming up this week in DX and contesting, there's not a lot going on because we're in spring. But Jose, Juliet Sierra, he's going to be in Dominica, but only till Friday. So if you need Dominica, you better get out there and work them quick. Also, Alpha Fox 1, Yankee/Kilo Hotel 0. Akira, he's going to be on one of the Mariana Islands June 4th through the 6th. He's actually going to be in Saipan at the Himawari Hotel. And the reason I bring this up, it's kind of cool. This hotel actually has a room set aside just for ham radio operators. It's got radios, amplifiers, antennas, coax, everything you need to operate DX, you know, work a little DX or do a contest, which I thought was kind of cool. So he'll be there June 4th through the 6th if you need Mariana Islands. And Not a lot of contests going on either now that we're heading into spring. There's three sprint contests going on this weekend, including the NCCC CW sprint ladder. Now, if you've never worked sprint before, it's quite different than a normal contest in that when you get out on the frequency and you call CQ, when somebody comes back to your call after you're done doing the exchange, that person that came back to your call, that's now their frequency, and they call CQ. And when someone comes back to them, once the exchange is done, the new caller gets that frequency. So nobody can just sit there and run a frequency, and no one can sit there and just search and pounce all night. Every other frequency, you're going to be calling CQ, and the opposite, every other frequency, you're going to be searching and pouncing. So for any of you that are a little microphone shy about getting out there and calling CQ, this might be a good way to get your feet wet. Although I warn you, it's a very fast-paced contest. If you've never done sprint before, I would suggest you get out there and for the first 5 minutes or so, just have a listen and try and pick up the rhythm of this contest, which is very fast, before hopping in so you don't get all flustered. But it's definitely a lot of fun. And that's why they're sprints. They're very quick, like the NCCC CW sprint contest this weekend. It's Friday morning UTC, which is really Thursday night for North America, 0230 to 0300. So it's only a half hour long, but boy, it's a fast half hour. And then I thought this was an interesting contest for perhaps even you, George. You might want to get in on this one. It's called the QRP Minimal Art Session. So I don't even know if it's a contest. It's a session. You can only use a radio that you yourself have built. It can be no more than 100 components, including a maximum of one integrated circuit. And since it's QRP, you can do no more than 5 watts. So that was kind of interesting for you homebrewers out there. You might want to get out there and give that a try. And that's about all I have for DXing and contesting this week. So for now, why don't we head it over to Amanda and see what kind of juicy stuff's going on in the chat room.
All right, thanks, Val, and very interesting contest, by the way. I have never listened to a sprint contest before, but I definitely plan on doing it now. Okay, so we have some pretty good questions here. There was definitely a lot of chatter about the mixer, George, so stay tuned. First, November Zulu 7 X-ray, he asks, how do I take an output from a mixer like that you showed on the video to the unbalanced mic input of something like a FT950.
Which one of us are you asking?
George.
Okay. We've shown that before. I can't remember the episode numbers right now. There's a couple of different ways you can do it. One is using a transformer, which is the way I like to do it. And I run the audio in the accessory port in the rear of the rig, rather than the mic jack, because that way you bypass the mic preamps and the front end stage of the radio and get the cleanest audio into the modulator. But go to the Ham Nation Wiki and do a little search there, and I think you'll come up with the episode number. But we've shown that two or three occasions, I think.
Very good. Okay, there was another audio question, so let's go to Bob. Bob, what are the pros and cons of using an analog mixer for your mic and audio input output versus the equalizer in modern rigs?
Well, first of all, before you get too far into that one, there's how you do it. And George just described it. There's the diagram I just scratched up. You really want to do it with a transformer, but you can do it with I use a T-pad myself of resistors, because if you use the output of the mixer into a real high-level mic preamp, you're going to overdrive it. This is the other side of it. You use some resistors and do that kind of a T-pad, and that allows you to take a high-level signal and drive it into that mic input. But yeah, it's best to go in the back, because then you bypass all this microphone preamp stuff, because none of these radios have real high quality mic preamps. They're noisy, but we don't care about that. Well, if you really want to do it right, you do care. And using it into the back is the way. And then the other thing that you're talking about is the outboard equalizer. The equalizer in these radios, all the ICOM is two band. Did you ever ask yourself, what frequency are they? Uh-huh. And boy, we could be here all night because it's my favorite subject. When I'm going to be in Nashville a week from Monday teaching at McBride's studio. We do a thing down there for the school at Blackbird Studios. They have an academy that's really great. And it's one of my great subjects because equalization is very important. And nobody talks about it much. It's bass and treble. Well, what frequency is that? Yeah, it's plus or minus 15. You can notch it or you can boost it. But what frequency is that? Well, it's set when you have two bands. Usually in the ICOMs, it's set at around 200 cycles on the low end. And the top end is set at about 2,500 cycles. But the situation is a lot of times your voice, your room, your microphone, maybe you need to move that up to maybe 400. 400 cycles is a toughie. I call it the cannon sound. When we go into these big halls, it's the first thing we do is notch out 400 cycles a little bit. And these are things that you have to have an ear. You got to really start listening for. And you can do it. You can be trained. But outboard equalizers, if you can get one with the mids that are switchable, in other words, you can move the frequency of the mids around. They're not set. They're movable. And, of course, the best of all is parametric. Because with the parametric, you can change all of the parameters. You can change the bandwidth. You can do a notch or a boost and the frequency. And it's fabulous. The problem with parametric is education. And, boy, maybe, George, we ought to get in one of these nights and do a whole hour parametric EQ. but you're better off to use an outboard mixer. And when you do, choose a mixer that has some form of variable, not just bass and treble, but that has variable frequency mids that you can move that all-important mid around a little bit. That's why we use better outboard mixers for equalization.
Thank you, Bob. I can't wait to watch that hour-long show, by the way. I think that we will all be very educated. I appreciate it, really. Okay, I do have... Val, I got a question for you. So we all realize what a DXer you are, but you're also a contester. So tell us about your favorite contest of the year.
Well, my favorite one has got to be CQ Worldwide Sideband. It's held in October every year, and pretty much everybody in the world is on that weekend. You know, actually, the last time I did 10 meters only, so I could sleep like a normal person because the band shuts down at night, and I could take a shower, and I could actually eat. So that was kind of nice. My cheeks hurt. I was smiling so much at the end of that contest because the band, just 10 meters, I never ran out of anybody to work. It was so much fun, and I always have a blast on that one. And I actually ended up working, you can easily work, even just on one band, 100 countries in one weekend. So that would be my favorite, I would guess.
Thank you. That's crazy. I worked that same contest. I think I got 26 countries and maybe 10 of them confirmed on LOTW. So you got to give us some more secrets on how you do it. Okay, one more question. And I'm going to send this out to George. What are your thoughts on ham sticks, and are they even worth the effort?
Oh, they're worth the effort. They're fairly inexpensive. Nice little antennas. You can get a lot of different bands. Now, you know, they're monoband antennas. You can only work one band with them, but, they make them for different bands. You'd have to swap, out for whatever band you wanted to work on. And you can take two of them, put them back to back on a stand and make a buddy pole dipole out of that. And those work pretty decent, too. In mobile, everything's a compromise antenna, particularly on the lower bands, because you just can't put that, you know, a 200-foot antenna on top of your car. So you're going to have some matchiness or inductors or something in there to kind of make up the difference there. And the hamsticks being a little longer antenna, I think maybe they have a little advantage. I've heard some people compare them with others, and they always got favorable results. So at the price, yeah, I don't think you can go wrong with them. It's not what I use, but I own some of them, and I would use them.
Very good. And I just have to tell you guys, Jeff, who drives 50 miles each way to work, he got wasps with his hamstick. So they're very functional. If you don't have much money to invest in an antenna, I would say that would be the way to go. Okay, let's see. Some chatter here. I'm looking forward to the UHF-VHF contest coming up on June, 13th, 14th? Anybody else going to do that?
Hopefully I'll be able to do that. Yeah, I hope to be on there for that.
Very good. You, Bob?
I don't think I'll be here, so I won't have any gear to do it. So that's sad.
Oh, that is. I'm going to do it for the first time. I'm doing it with a club. You know, they've got the crazy 6-meter, they call it Chernobyl, some crazy 6-meter alpha amp. And evidently it buzzes even when it's turned off. So I'm looking forward to that for sure. All right, you guys. Well,
and Amanda, I did it last year, and I just got my wallpaper in the mail. I don't know if you can see this.
Did you?
But I got first place, Illinois. Woohoo!
Wow.
All right.
That is great. Now, that was an individual?
Yes. I did it last year from my boyfriend's QTH in Illinois, and that was my first UHF-VHF contest, and I guess I did pretty good.
Very good. That's awesome. Okay.
Hey, George. Wait a minute, Amanda. Just a minute. Yes. Hey, George, isn't that cheating when you use your boyfriend's ham radio station? Is that cheating, George?
Oh, no.
You know, I think we need to look in the rules and see, Bob. Surely the ARRL's got something on that in there.
Really?
You're not going to take away my award, are you?
The main point of that. No, you got your award. It's okay, but there might be a next one. The problem is, or the situation is, George, I think we should see something about any towers that are over 200 foot. I wouldn't count or something like that.
His towers are 185 feet, so we're good.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't even have to light it.
Yeah, right. I know you had fun, and that's great. That's great. Amanda, we'll let you know if I'm going to make that contest, and we'll talk to you next week about it. I won't know until then, but I hope I can, because I love that too. It's fun. Maybe
that
the band
will.
I worked a bunch of guys in Colorado yesterday, so maybe we'll get to hear you guys.
All right. Speaking of Colorado, worked WNAW-0, 40 meters, like 5 nights in a row. Most exhausting thing I've ever done in my life, but met a lot of fun people on there, and thanks everyone for your patience.
Oh, golly, that's great. And then people want to know, why do you watch this show? Because we have fun. That's why. It's ham radio at its best. What can I tell you? We have some great people. Great thing. That was really super, Amanda. And what can I tell you about all of the stuff that you brought us from? You didn't bring us all this stuff. There are other things that happen after dark in some of those DX rooms, but that's okay. We're okay with all that. They have fun. Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that most of the things that happen at Dayton for the contest and DXers, they pretty much have their own little hamvention down at the plaza, but it's really great. It's a serious part of this hobby, that's for sure. And we are so happy to have you with us and making it happen, Valerie. That's great, because we need somebody to bring that arm of ham radio to us. And as we get along, I want you to explain more and more how to some of us neophytes in the contest and can get into it. But we know that'll happen. Well, we're really happy that things worked out tonight, and we'll be back here next week. You'll want to be looking for Gordon tonight on 7268. He's going to try to check in from his communications van. So we'll be looking for him. Amanda, you're going to be on 40 meters, right?
I'm hoping so. We have some thunderstorms in the area, but hopefully they'll blow over in no time.
Okay, that's good. And I don't know if Bill's going to be on and if any of the other guys will be on, but 14268 usually full with great big signals. And I'm not sure. George, have you seen anything on the frequencies? Is that where we're going tonight, 268, or do you know?
Well, I've seen him post 14268. That wasn't Bill who posted it, but I believe that's where it'll be tonight. And we'll have the Echo Link Net on Star Do Drop In Star or node number 355-800. And the D-Star Net, where I believe we'll catch Don tonight on Reflector 14, Module C. So join us on one of those nets after the show.
All right. That'll be great. All right, everybody. Well, we'll find you on one of those things over there. And in the meantime, get on the air, have fun, and pass the word that ham radio is definitely growing and we're having way too much fun and you want to join and have all your friends join us. And we're all here for the emergencies that we can handle in amateur radio, and that's the most important thing is we have all this fun and it allows us to test our signals, test our radios, test our stations to see what we can do should anything happen. And when it does, guess who's there first? Amateur radio in the emergencies. That's great. Well, 7-3, everybody. Best regards. We'll see you on the air. And, of course, we'll see you right back here next week on Ham Nation. Thanks to Leo Laporte, Brian, and everybody back in Petaluma that put this show together. So long and bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye, everybody. Have a great week.
Bye. Goodbye. Good night.
7-3.
See ya.